Alexan Smilov becomes Kazakhstan's new prime minister, following days of violent unrest that led to the dismissal of the cabinet. More than 1.35 million new COVID cases in the U.S., the highest daily total for any country in the world. And a new missile test by North Korea in a matter of days draws the ire of Seoul and Tokyo. Thanks for joining us. Kazakhstan has been in the headlines for the past week over protests against fuel price hikes that led to the resignation of the cabinet. Now the country has a new prime minister. Just a short while ago, parliament voted to appoint Alexan Smilov as the new premier. President Kasym Tokayev has appointed Smilov to form a new cabinet. He served as deputy prime minister in the previous government that resigned last week when the unrest erupted. The protests were peaceful in the beginning, but they later became deadly and violent. Nearly 10,000 people are now in detention. The Interior Ministry says rioters attacked government buildings in several major cities. The president blames foreign militants, mainly from Central Asia, Afghanistan, and West Asia, for the chaos, calling it a coup attempt. Russia deployed its troops to help restore peace, but Tokayev says foreign troops will be leaving in 2 days. Dmitry Zolotarev is a journalist and political commentator. He believes that the West has likely initiated the unrest in Kazakhstan to pressure Russia over the Ukraine issue. Let's take a listen.
First of all, Kazakhstan has always been a specific arena of interests for Western policy. So it was a question of time when it was going to happen. So now we witness it happened. So I have no doubts that it has been a coup, an attempt to overthrow a government of Tokayev. So maybe by some forces inside Kazakhstan and with big help of forces, you know, from you know where, I suspect, that from the United States and the other NATO countries, how it happened in the Ukraine. So it's lines up. NATO presses Russia, comes closer, and Kazakhstan would be a perfect arena for them to get into and to take over.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson faces fresh pressure over the breach of COVID rules. A leaked email shows his Downing Street residence hosted a party during the first national lockdown. According to British broadcaster ITV, the email was sent by one of Johnson's top aides on May 20, 2020. It invited over 100 employees to a socially distanced party that evening to, quote, make the most of the lovely weather. Around 40 staff gathered in the Downing Street garden, including Johnson and his wife. At the time, only two people were allowed to socialize outside by maintaining 2-meter distance. Johnson's office has declined to comment on the latest revelation. However, the opposition Labour Party accuses Johnson of having no regard for the rules that he puts in place for the rest of the people. A year after the death of a 24-year-old black British Somali man, shortly after his release from Welsh police custody, his family's quest for answers is still ongoing. Said Pureza reports from the victim's hometown of Cardiff.
On January 9th last year, the Hassan family of Somali origin living in Cardiff, Wales, were stricken by grief. Their son, 24-year-old Mohammed Hassan, found dead in his own apartment.
Around 10:30 at night, Mohammed was discovered by a friend when he tried to wake him up to go to the hospital, and they realized he was dead.
Hassan, who was only months away from being a father, was arrested on January 8th on suspicion of a breach of the peace, moved here and detained overnight.
It soon emerged that while he was here, Mahmoud came into contact with over 50 members of Cardiff Police. The next morning, he was released without a charge. When he went home, his family say he was battered and bruised and his clothing splattered in blood. He went to bed later that same day, never to wake up again.
That raised red flags for his family, who then demanded to see police body cam footage of his detention. 1 year on, they're still waiting.
By the look of it, we're not going to be able to see the footage. But if we were allowed to see the footage, if we were allowed to see the last hours of Mahmoud's life, then we would be able to, regardless of what we saw, we would be able to move on. We would be able to grieve, but we would have a closure.
An investigation launched last year by the IOPC, the police watchdog in charge of the probe, is still ongoing. So far, it served misconduct notices to 6 officers and questioned more than 40 others. Hassan's family have criticized attempts to blame him for his own death, a reference to the coroner's report last year that Hassan had been drinking and taking drugs and gotten into a fight on the night of his arrest.
If you're from a black or African, Caribbean or Asian descent in this country, you know that deaths in custody are often followed by attempts to besmirch the reputation of the victim or the victim's family. No difference in this case. But can we just say absolutely for the record that the toxicology reports do not support that assertion?
Those supporting the Hassan family in their quest for the truth say his death is yet another incident in which a black person has died after contact with British police. For Hassan's family, closure on his unexplained death is yet to come. Saeed Puriza, Cardiff, Wales.
Release the footage!
Concerns over an uptick in Omicron are forcing new lockdowns in China, where local COVID outbreaks are reported in multiple cities. Millions of residents in Anyang will have to stay home after about 60 new infections were detected there. It's the third city in Henan province to introduce restrictions. The new cases in the affected cities are still far lower than in Omicron hotspots such as the U.S. and Europe. But the spread is especially causing concerns ahead of the Beijing Winter Olympics. Meanwhile, Australia has reported 86,000 infections in just 24 hours. That is a high figure for a country that's received praise for its success in curbing the disease. The country has seen its total caseload more than double in 2 weeks. The surge in Omicron is straining the national health system there. Moving on to the United States, where the pandemic is entering uncharted territory. The country is witnessing a dramatic surge, reporting more than 1.3 million additional cases. That is the highest daily total of any nation in the world. The extremely contagious Omicron variant is largely to blame for the rise. The strain has already pushed medical centers to the brink. The number of hospitalizations has hit a new peak. Over 140,000 COVID patients have been admitted to hospitals nationwide. Vaccine maker Pfizer says a redesigned vaccine is likely needed to specifically target Omicron. UN experts are urging the United States to shut down its notorious Guantanamo Bay prison, calling it an ugly chapter of unrelenting human rights violations. More than a dozen human rights experts have voiced outrage at the detention camps still operating in Cuba. They say that 20 years of arbitrary detention without trial, accompanied by torture of inmates, is simply unacceptable for any government, especially the one that claims to be the defender of human rights. UN experts describe the facility as a site of unparalleled notoriety and a stain on Washington's stated commitment to the rule of law. They urge the U.S. to close the site, return detainees to home, or to save third countries, and provide remedy and reparation for those tortured and detained arbitrarily. The notorious prison was established in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. California University professor Paul Sheldon Foote sounds pessimistic about a probable closure of Guantanamo. He says that all previous attempts to shut down the facility have failed due to a false idea that someday the U.S. is going to run trials for the detainees.
Before Guantanamo, where were these prisoners? They were in CIA dark sites. Where are the voters complaining about those dark sites in other countries that we operate? And as you noted, President Obama, in his first week in office, had his executive order in 2008, but that fell apart because one of the provisions was, well, we're going to send some of them to the United States and put them on trial in either federal courts or military courts. Oh, yeah? That killed it right there. You're really going to trust the court system in this country? And so even though he had a majority in the Senate and the House of Representatives of Democrats, he couldn't push it through. Because it all fails on this idea that we're going to run trials. What kind of trials can you run? Where can you get witnesses? Where can you get a jury of peers and so forth? I mean, it falls apart, and they're not willing to send them home.
Japan and South Korea say that Pyongyang has fired an unidentified projectile toward the East Sea. The Japanese Coast Guard says the launch could be a ballistic missile. That's North Korea's second apparent launch in less than a week after its leader, Kim Jong-un, pledged to boost the country's military to counter an unstable international situation. Pyongyang also announced last week that it successfully test-fired a hypersonic missile. The launch has come amid a standoff between North Korea and its southern neighbors over a host of issues, including U.S.-South Korea joint war games on the peninsula. South Korean and Japanese officials have condemned the launches, saying they risk destabilizing the already volatile region. Our Seoul correspondent Frank Smith elaborates on North Korea's latest missile launch. He says that the country has repeatedly test-fired its missiles against the backdrop of U.S. sanctions.
Well, they're not really releasing a lot of information here in South Korea, you know, partly because perhaps they don't know that much. They said in a text message, it's been reported, that they divulged this launch by North Korea that just comes less than a week after North Korea launched a hypersonic glide missile. And also, I think significantly follows one day after a statement from the United Nations condemning North Korea for that previous launch. No mention is the biting U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea that are affecting the country's ability to, you know, battle the coronavirus, import things like vaccines and other medicines to help treat North Koreans, as well as trade for foodstuffs and other items on the international market. And those things need to be addressed and might be behind North Korea's, you know, launches and provoking, hopefully, the international community to respond to what it views as unfair treatment from, again, U.S.-led United Nations measures.
The U.S. says it needs $5 billion in aid to stop Afghanistan from sinking into a humanitarian crisis this year. That is the organization's biggest ever appeal for a single country.
This is a stopgap, an absolutely essential stopgap measure that we are putting in front of the international community today. Without this being funded, there won't be a future. We need this to be done. Otherwise, there will be outflow. There will be suffering.
Griffiths is warning that the absence of humanitarian aid could lead to more deaths, hunger, and further mass displacement. He says the funding would help the Afghan economy and facilitate humanitarian agencies' operations there. A lack of funding is battering Afghanistan's already troubled economy. The country is on the edge of a full-blown crisis, with Washington freezing billions of dollars of its assets since the Taliban takeover in mid-August. As a result, aid supplies have been disrupted, leading to rising poverty and hunger. Iran hands over batches of humanitarian aid to millions of poor and needy Afghans amid harsh winter. As a neighboring country, Iran has always stood by Afghans, regardless of political issues. Afghanistan is facing what UN agencies have described as one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters since the collapse of the Kabul in mid-August. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
As Afghans are struggling with a rising hunger combined with harsh winter, the Iranian embassy in Kabul, in cooperation with Imam Khomeini Relief Foundation, distributes rounds of aid and food to vulnerable people across Afghanistan.
Iran's humanitarian aid to the Afghan people is continuing in different provinces of Afghanistan. In the capital, Kabul, we aim to provide vulnerable families with food and warm clothes. Today, these batches of relief assistance, including flour, oil, and rice, are going to be distributed among Afghan teachers and unemployed people.
Unemployment, cash shortage, and the rise in prices have switched many to poverty and hunger. nowadays as winter sets in, millions of Afghans are awaiting relief assistance.
We're absolutely in need of such aid. I have a family of 10. We thank Iranian people for helping us in this dire situation. Their aid can help us survive one more month. We also demand Islamic countries and the international community to support us in this harsh winter, as we are short of food and warm shelter.
I'm a teacher and have 8 children. My husband is jobless. I have been unpaid for 4 months. Nowadays, we really don't have anything to eat or heat our houses. Other teachers have the same difficult situation. What should we do if we don't rely on foreign aid? I hope such aid continues for all throughout this winter.
Iran has delivered 14 rounds of aid to the people of Afghanistan since the Taliban took over and the financial crisis in August. This comes as nearly $10 billion in Afghan assets remain frozen by the U.S., and a large number of funds to the country are halted. Harsh winter in Afghanistan is worsening the dire situation, adding to the number of people in need. Most families are relying on such assistance because it is a matter of survival for them. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
U.S. military convoys in Iraq have been targeted again amid a recent surge in similar attacks. According to Iraqi media reports, a convoy was struck with an improvised explosive device in Al-Muthanna Governorate early on Tuesday. The blast has not caused any damage. Separately, a U.S. convoy has been targeted in Baghdad. So far, we have no additional details about that attack. Anti-U.S. sentiment has been growing in Iraq over its military and political interventions in the region. Last week, several drone and rocket strikes were carried out against different U.S. bases. And that is for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می‌کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini strongly criticized the cinematic art of the previous regime, as it was one of the main sources of immorality in society, particularly among the young generation. He correctly believed that the dramatic arts, mainly cinema, were the tools of colonial policies of the West and anti-Islamic propaganda of the U.S. and its accomplices in the country. This week, we are going to discuss Imam Khomeini's views on political parties and groups, which were, in fact, the puppets of the big powers in Iran. Stay tuned, please. During the years of a struggle against the despotic Pahlavi regime in Iran, different groups resorted to various methods to topple the ruling system. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, or MKO, was one of those groups which tried to change the political system via armed struggle. The MKO was formed in 1965 with combination of two contradictory ideologies of Islam and Marxism. This organization managed to take a few terrorist acts against the regime, but in 1971, many of its leaders were identified, tortured, or executed by the intelligence apparatus of the regime, called SAVAK. In 1975, some of the MKO ringleaders, through an organizational coup, officially changed the ideology of the group led to Marxism and committed gruesome murders against their opponents thereafter. Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, there emerged differences of opinion among the MKO leaders and the revolutionary leaders to the extent that, following the dismissal of President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr by the parliament, the MKO started armed activities against the Islamic Republic system and martyred a number of officials and thousands of civilians. After the Iraqi invasion of Iran in 1980, the MKO terrorist outfit transferred its base to Iraq and continued its measures against the Iranian nation. Some of the Western countries tried to put the name of the MKO in the blacklist of terrorist groups to stop its crimes against humanity. But through the pressures of influential regimes, especially the United States, they failed to pursue their demands. The terrorist outfit has been employed by Washington, Tel Aviv, and London as a tool to pursue their nefarious goals against the Iranian nation and the Islamic Republic system. The founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, writes in his testament, "My advice and recommendation to the groups, grouplets, and persons who are active against the nation, the Islamic Republic and Islam, first, in addressing their ringleaders inside and outside the country, is that the long experience of taking any measure, designing any plot, and resorting to any country and official should have taught to you, who consider yourselves as knowledgeable and wise, that the course of a selfless nation cannot be misled by resorting to terror, blast, bomb, and baseless and uncalculated lies. Never can any state and government be toppled through inhumane and illogical methods, especially a nation like Iran, whose young children to its old women and men are sacrificing their lives in the way of the goal, the Islamic Republic, the Quran, and religion. You know, and if you do not, you are thinking very naively that the nation is not with you and the army is not with you. And if you suppose that they have been with you as your friends, your bungling acts and crimes that have occurred through your provocation have separated them from you, and you have failed to do anything except forging enemies." Unquote. Imam Khomeini, addressing terrorist groups, especially the MKO, writes in another part of his testament, "In the end of my life, I benevolently recommend you who have started fighting and countering this afflicted nation, which has saved itself from the oppression of criminals like the Pahlavi regime and the world devourers of the East and the West through sacrificing their best children and youth. How can the conscience of a human, no matter how wicked it is, to be content for the likely achieving of a position to behave his country and his nation in this way and does not have mercy towards their young and the elderly? The Imam advises the ringleaders of these grouplets not to be deceived by big powers. He writes, I advise you to give up such useless and unwise acts and not be gulled by the world devourers. And wherever you are, if you have committed crime, return to your country and the lap of Islam. Repent, as God is the most merciful of the merciful, and the Islamic Republic and the nation will, inshallah, forgive you. And if you have committed a crime that God has determined your decree, still return from halfway and return. Or if you are not brave enough, accept the punishment, and hence, save yourselves from God's painful punishment. Otherwise, wherever you are, do not waste your life anymore and embark on another job as it is to your benefit. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing the internal and external advocates of the MKO terrorist grouplet, writes in his testament, then I recommend their internal and external advocates, for what motive do you waste your youth for those whom have been proved to be serving the powerful world devourers and follow their schemes and have been fallen in their traps? In whose way are you wronging your own nation? You are the beguiled of them, and if you are in Iran, you're witnessing that the million-strong masses are loyal to the Islamic Republic and sacrifice for it. And you are witnessing that the current state and regime are wholeheartedly at the service of the destitute. And those who are spuriously feigning popularity, being mujahid and devotees of the people, have embarked on enmity against God's people and have beguiled you simple boys and girls for their purposes and the purposes of one of the world-devouring poles of power. Whereas they are either reveling in the lap of one of the criminal poles or inside the country, they are leading a luxurious life in team houses like the houses of the wretched criminals while sending you youth to death. My kind advice to you teenagers and youth inside and outside is to return from the wrong way and be united with the deprived of the society who are serving the Islamic Republic wholeheartedly. And be active for the independent and free Iran, to that the country and the nation get rid of the evil of the opponents and all continue noble life together. How long and why will you be subordinate to those who do not think except for their vested interest? You are fighting your nation in the lap of the superpowers while they have sacrificed you for their sinister purposes and seeking power. Thank you.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. Top U.S. and Russian officials have held crucial security talks, with Moscow saying the talks made no progress on Ukraine's NATO membership ban. NATO has also weighed in on the talks. All the pressure was exerted on China, or Russia, that is, when it came, for example, to Ukraine and its possible NATO membership. But Russia is not sitting idly by. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why there was little hope of any breakthroughs, while at the same time, we will look at whether there will be any agreements, like on NATO's eastward expansion. We'll also ask whether Western fears of a Russian so-called invasion of its pro-Western neighbor Ukraine is justified. Jerome Hughes joins us now from Brussels to shed light on the most recent developments. We know Russia has spoken on this. Tell us about that, because there's some major breakthroughs there. And, of course, from the U.S. side, if there's anything also on that front.
The talks, as you mentioned, they came to nothing in Geneva. So those talks were disastrous. And now we're expecting more talks to take place this week here in Brussels, in Belgium, and also in Vienna, in Austria. But it's anticipated that there will be very little progress also in Brussels, because you have more people around the table, and therefore you have big personalities, more sort of anti-Russia people to attend that meeting. And therefore, we're not anticipating a big breakthrough in Brussels. I mean, from Russia's perspective, the red line, according to Putin, is for Ukraine to join NATO. And of course, you know, you can understand, if you speak to security analysts, they point out that in recent years, there's just been a build-up, more and more military drills, so-called war games, as close to Russia's borders as possible, you know, on the Black Sea and also in NATO countries close to Russia. And so if it was a situation that Ukraine was to join NATO, you can imagine that that provocation would just increase. So that is a red line for Putin. We're not seeing where this is going to go in terms of escalation. But when I speak to experts in the field, they say, look, I mean, sort of a conventional, even a conventional military interaction or war with Russia is simply out of the question, really, because it just could escalate into nuclear war, which could have global catastrophe. So really, we've heard for years as well from experts that a war is not an option with Russia. And so the answer, perhaps, again, according to even some of the lawmakers in the European Parliament I've been speaking to, is to try and de-escalate the tensions with Russia, stop the anti-Russia rhetoric. Russia is a major supplier of energy to the European Union. They also trade, apart from energy, they also have some trade that used to be greater before Russia imposed reciprocal sanctions in terms of, you know, on agricultural products from the EU in response to EU sanctions. And so there's a feeling that the only way forward with Russia is to tone things down, stop the anti-Russia rhetoric, and try to get it on a more normal footing. But as things stand right now, and with these talks coming up in Brussels and Vienna, it doesn't look like that's likely.
Thank you for that, Jerome Hughes. We do appreciate it. Let me now introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have a senior research fellow, the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli, joining us from Budapest. We also have columnist and author, Patrick Lawrence. He joins us from Norfolk, Connecticut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay. Let me first start with you, Patrick Lawrence. We're looking at the most recent statement from the talks, in which you had the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Ryabkov, said that no progress was made. Does that surprise you?
No, not particularly. I'm not sure the Western Alliance, Washington, its allies in Europe, particularly want a lot of progress here. It's a question of how each side views this current impasse. In my read, Moscow has taken a large view. Let us rethink our circumstances altogether. Western press reports note with some alarm Russia wants to redraw European security architecture. That may count as a rather good description of what Russia seeks, and it's a pretty good idea. But I don't think the Western Alliance has this in mind. I don't think they almost certainly don't want a reduction in tensions. In my view, I've written this in various columns, they know they can't win a war with Russia. And so the intent is to maintain tensions at a very high level. That's useful enough.
Okay, I see. Well, let me bring in George Tomioli, if I may. He is a senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, who joins us from Budapest. George Tomioli, welcome. So our guest there talks about how the Western Alliance wants to keep pressure on Russia, but doesn't want to get involved in a war. Now, at the same time, we do have Russia that's very assertive, and in their mind, quite rightly so. But what Sergei Ryabkov has said here is very interesting, and I'd like to find out from you, in response to any failure of security talks, that it would be of a military technical nature. Furthermore, in another part of his statements, he said that he urged Washington, that is, not to underestimate the risk of a confrontation. How close are we to that?
Well, it's hard to say how close we are to that. I think it depends on what the West does in the near future. I think if, for instance, Ukraine launches any kind of an offensive against the Donbass, that will almost certainly trigger some kind of a Russian military intervention in Ukraine. If the United States and NATO start deploying heavy forces, stationing heavy weaponry in Ukraine, that also could trigger a Russian intervention. I think given that NATO and the United States have ruled out addressing the security concerns that Russia raised in those two documents, Russia now is saying, look, we've done our bit. We've proposed some kind of a mutually acceptable security framework, a kind of revamped Helsinki Final Act.
Right.
So now we are just going to take unilateral action whenever we deem things to be an existential threat to us, much as President Kennedy threatened to do in 1962 at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Again, you know, he felt that stationing missiles in Cuba was an existential threat to the United States, and basically told the Russians, either you take the missiles out or we will. I think the Russians are just saying that that's our position now. You haven't addressed our concerns, so now we're just going to act unilaterally whenever we think that there's a serious security threat facing
us. Well, here's a part that's confusing here. Maybe you could shed light on it, Patrick Lawrence. I mean, when you take a look at the different exchanges that took place prior to this, I mean, this meeting, when you have the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister in attendance, when you have the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, in attendance, and you're also going to have meetings of the NATO-Russia Council to take place in Brussels, and then the Permanent Council of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe also to meet. We can see how big and important this is. But the answers were exchanged between the two sides, before coming into this, and we're getting the first signals of the failure of the talks. Do you think that there are any chances of anything being resolved here on any point, which we're going to talk about, such as Ukraine, such as NATO's eastward expansion?
Well, you know, I'd be interested in the comments of your correspondent in Brussels and George, for that matter. It starts to shape up that these talks in three European capitals this week are a matter of form, a matter of going through the motions. As you've just suggested, could it be that everything has been decided already and there's simply going to be no progress? It's very depressing. I draw some encouragement from the fact that Russia has a very good set of cards here. I don't think NATO would dare go in directly into Ukraine. It looks like membership is, for the time being, off the table, although they are not saying so. What seems to be going on?
Why do you think it's off the table?
What I mean is this. Let me finish. What I mean is they're not going to press for membership, but they're going to make Ukraine a de facto member. Stoltenberg, Jens Stoltenberg, NATO's chief, is already saying, look, Ukraine's a partner. We can't make it a member right now, but it's a partner. And I think they're based there. The focus now seems to be creating facts on the ground and worry about treaties and fountain pens at another moment, right? That I find worrisome.
Well, George Samueli, on Ukraine and the point that our guests there made, could it be that even though Stoltenberg today said we are entertaining that thought, that they haven't done that yet because Ukraine has expressed obviously its interest from a while back, that Ukraine is being used in a sense where they're going to be on the offensive, hoping that NATO or the U.S. or a combination is going to come to its rescue. Do you think that that's a scenario that could be a possibility here?
Well, yeah, and I think that this is the most depressing aspect of it because, you know, from NATO's perspective, and NATO doesn't give a damn about Ukraine, but what they like about Ukraine is that it gives Russia a headache. This ongoing war in the southeast of Ukraine is a real headache for Russia. I mean, Russia wants to resolve this problem, but it's finding it very hard to do simply because Kiev absolutely refuses to agree to the Minsk Accord. So, you know, Kiev wants this essential tension to continue. NATO wants this tension to continue. So if it happens that Russia is forced to intervene militarily to protect the Donbass from Kiev, it will mean an enormous rift between Russia and Europe. I mean, it'll bring to an end all of Russia's hopes of using German investment and technical know-how to develop their country. All of Russia's hopes of building a partnership with Europe, it'll all come to an end. For NATO, and particularly the United States, this is great news because it'll be a big boost for NATO because it's going to actually put, energize NATO, and, you know, everyone's going to be on board for increasing NATO spending and, escalate the hysterical NATO rhetoric. It's great for the United States because they've always dreaded the prospect of a European-Russian partnership. And Ukraine, you know, which has now lost Crimea, has lost the Donbass, could then be incorporated within NATO because, hey, why not? There isn't a conflict any longer in the country. They've lost the territory, but now there's no conflict. Therefore, Ukraine is eligible for membership. It no longer has a conflict on its territory. I think it's a terrible scenario. I hope it doesn't happen, but I think it's a possibility.
Well, I'd like to pick up on that point that you made in terms of how the U.S. does not really, or overall, of what I've picked up from you, that the U.S. doesn't like this partnership between Europe and Russia. And
it's an excellent point.
Yeah, and let's break that open for us, if you can, Patrick Lawrence. And I'm going to come in at you with what extreme measures that they're thinking of executing against Russia. And I'm looking at some of them. sanctions on Putin's inner circle, canceling Russia's controversial Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Aha, something that obviously the U.S. wants to not happen so it could sell its own gas. And in the most drastic scenario, serving Russia's links to the world's banking system. You can see all of this could be a win situation for the U.S. Could it be these are underlying interests of the U.S. in this whole thing that's panning out?
As George just suggested, there's no question of this. Basically, the Americans have their finger in the dike, and let's call the dike history, right? Interdependence between Russia and Western Europe, I think, is inevitable, and the Americans dread it. It means the end of the Atlantic Alliance as it has been known since 45, right? I don't think there's any stopping this. Certain European leaders are perfectly aware of this. One of them is Macron, French president. Merkel seems to have understood this at certain points during her chancellorship. And the Americans want to stop this. Nord Stream 2 was rather emblematic of the effort. And it now transpires that they haven't given up on Nord Stream 2 even after it's completed. As George said, very worrisome. But I think the drift of events in coming years, I'm talking medium term now, not immediately, is greatly in favor of a very productive interdependence between the Russian Federation and nations around it and Western Europe. I'd love to see it. Right. Time marches on.
Well, another thing that's very a big question mark over here, and George Samueli, it's a statement that Wendy Sherman made that from the U.S., and I'm going to quote what she said. The U.S. will listen to Russia's concerns and share our own, but we have been clear we will not discuss European security without our allies and partners. So what is the U.S. doing there? I mean, why isn't Ursula von der Leyen there, the European Commission President, representing Europe?
Yeah, that's right. The West position since the end of the Cold War was that we will show no respect whatsoever for Russia. Russia is not the same as the Soviet Union. You know, it's half the size of the Soviet Union, and therefore doesn't deserve any of the respect that we once showed towards the Soviet Union. It's now broken up into 15 republics, and any of those republics will be scooped up by us NATO. We've already scooped up the former Warsaw Pact allies of Russia. We've already scooped up the three Baltic states. Now we're kind of moving in on Georgia and Ukraine, promised membership in 2008, Moldova, and then onwards towards Central Asia and towards the Far East. Every single one of the former republics of the USSR is a target of NATO. They're going to put all of that in and push Russia out of everything. I mean, that's the goal. I'm not saying they're going to achieve it, but that's been the goal. So they don't have any respect for Russia. So they just think these are ridiculous demands. But what has changed is Russia has now become much stronger than it was a few years ago. And now I think they've got the West's attention. And they're kind of realizing that we can't just go on like this because it could lead ultimately to a military conflict. But I think that if the United States and Stoltenberg, the kind of errand boy, if they succeed in kind of essentially forging a permanent rift between Russia and Europe, I think that then they will say, job well done. You know, we succeeded. I mean, just like the coup in 2014 when they toppled Yanukovych, I think this is a job well done. We've done it, minimum expense to us, and it's a real serious problem for Russia. And I think that that I think is the danger, that they're trying to provoke Russian intervention in Ukraine, which would then trigger this rift between permanent rift between Russia and Europe.
Well, if we were to take an optimistic view for the next few days, at a minimum at least, moving forward here, what are we looking at in terms of the core issues? For example, when we talk about eastward expansion of NATO, Patrick Lawrence, or if we're talking about the Ukraine in terms of the troop buildup by Russia, which, by the way, there are no aerials given of this troop buildup by Russia. We don't see the tens of thousands of Russian troops, as they have said. Anyways, even if they were to get an agreement on any of these issues, well, NATO has backed out of its promises of its eastward expansion. The U.S. has torn up international agreements. So how can Russia even depend and trust on any agreement that may come out of these talks?
Yeah, you know, you make an excellent point. It's very possible that Ukraine becomes something like NATO's Waterloo. It's probable that it will not, it's almost certain that NATO is not going to go into Ukraine directly. And I think it's going to refrain from any substantive moves toward membership. And in that case, if I prove correct here, NATO will have defined its own limits. It will have created a swamp all by itself and then fallen into it. And so, you know, once again, I think it's an excellent thing that that Russia has various advantages in this, because I have no belief whatsoever that Russia wants to go into Ukraine. It's all you read about in the dailies over here and on the networks. There's no indication whatsoever that Russia wants to go into Ukraine, right? And that's a very fine thing.
Okay,
it shouldn't.
George Samueli, in conclusion over here, of course, we know that this is about Russia, Ukraine, and NATO's eastward expansion at the top of the list. But could it be that there are other discussions taking place involving other issues that will play as pieces in this chessboard, perhaps a give and take, even though Russia has said it's not going to give any concessions, in order for this situation to get resolved in one way or another on any of these issues?
Well, they're talking about revamping the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. And the Americans have sounded relatively positive about that. I'm very skeptical that anything much is going to happen here, because the United States would then have to make substantial concessions. I mean, the United States have been violating the INF Treaty, basically the whole kind of nonsense of setting up these missile defense systems in Romania and now in Poland. I mean, that's basically a missile is a missile, and those are missiles that can carry nuclear warheads, and they are intermediate range nuclear missiles. So the United States is already violating that.
Okay.
So they would have to give all that up in order to have a revamped INF treaty. I don't think that they're going to do that.
All right, very well. We're fresh out of time. Thank you very much for that, George Samueli, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute. Patrick Welch, thank you. I'm sorry, Patrick Lawrence, thank you, from Norfolk, Connecticut, columnist and author. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitaly, it's goodbye until next time.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his prophet progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all over the world. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from a series of Canon Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. As you have been following and listening such shows from IRIB English Radio, in this series of shows we are trying to talk about the questions and, let's say, the doubts and misconceptions that we are receiving from different questioners all around the world. For that, we have invited Islamic researcher and scholar Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary Schools to the show to help us to answer the questions. Before asking the first question, I'd like to welcome Sheikh to the show and say salam to him. Salam alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting the invitation. The question of the day that we want to ask it here and actually discuss it with the respected guest, the speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, is about the event of Ghadir. Ghadir is the day that Imam Ali alayhi salam has been appointed by the Holy Prophet in Hajjatul Wada, and the way back to Medina, in an area called Ghadir, as the first successor of the Holy Prophet and the Imam of the Islamic Ummah right after the Holy Prophet. So the question is that why Imam Ali alayhi salam and Lady Fatima salamullah alayha, in their own life at the time of caliphate of the first and second caliphs, never referred to the event of Ghadir? And also, before that, why they never even talked about this right after the demise of the Holy Prophet, at the time that people were busy in Saqifah Bani Sa'adah to make decision for the successor of the Holy Prophet? This is the core of the question today. I want Sheikh Nur Muhammad to shed some light on that, and actually to answer this question from two phases. One, why didn't they, Imam Ali alayhi salam and Lady Fatima salam ala alayha, react to what had happened right after the demise of the Holy Prophet at the time of Saqifah, when some companions of the Holy Prophet went to a place entitled or called as Saqifah Bani Sa'ad and made a decision for the successor of the Holy Prophet and the Caliph after the Prophet? What was the reason that they were silent?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, you know that Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, for numerous times and occasion, on different occasions, starting from the beginning of the caliphate of Abu Bakr, he started, arguing against the caliph system.
Yeah.
And of course, it has been quoted and narrated by the Sunni scholars. They have been mentioned. If you let me introduce you one source for that. You can refer to Al-Qadir and Allama Amini in that book. He introduced more than 100 pages about the argument and Al-Ihtijajat wal-Munashadat of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, which means the arguments of Imam Ali against the caliphate from the Sunni narrators.
Yeah.
And Imam Ali mentioned that, of course, on numerous times and occasions. Of course, in the beginning of the caliphate system and in the Saqifah, it was a very complicated time and occasion. And, of course, in that time, while Imam Ali, alayhi salatu wasalam, and the companions of the noble prophet, most of the companions, of course, they joined the army of Osama. And of course, some of the, Ahlul Bayt and the particular companion, they were engaging in the, doing qus and the ablution for the noble prophets, and of course the process of the burial possession for the noble prophet.
Yeah.
In that, difficult time, suddenly the Saqifah happened.
Yeah.